U.S. and destroy democracy. It's a $150 gift in support of Background Briefing at KPFK at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or online at kpfk.org. And I want to thank everybody who's donated today and throughout this summer fund drive. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and live around the world at kpfk.org.
It's Thursday, August 6th. I'm Scott Baba. Iran and Oman say they're close to reaching a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, even as President Donald Trump insists the waterway is already under U.S. control.
It's sort of open right now. You know, we have a thing called the blockade headed up by the U.S. Navy, and we control it. And now we control it, but they can always shoot something. They always have something or drop a mine.
Scientists say the upcoming El Niño weather pattern could be one of historic proportions.
Not all El Niño events are equal. And this one in particular, right now, is already a strong event as it has developed thus far and is expected to strengthen considerably from here and could even become potentially the strongest on record. In fact, that is what some of the best predictive models are currently indicating as a distinct possibility.
And the Federal Communication Commission ends an 85-year-old rule meant to prevent media consolidation and control.
Today's decision to eliminate the 39% national audience reach cap is unlawful on its face and a profound departure from both statutory boundaries and longstanding broadcasting policy.
These stories and more coming up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, this is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. Iran says a deal with Oman to manage traffic through the Strait of Hormuz is close, with reports suggesting Tehran could control inbound ship traffic while Oman oversees outbound traffic. But Iranian officials are pushing back on the idea that it amounts to a full reopening. Iran's state news agency said the framework represents a, quote, new security model for the waterway, not a return to how it operated before the war. And a senior Iranian lawmaker told state media the talks are strictly about vessel movement and routes, not reopening the strait, saying that would require the U.S. to end its threats, lift its blockade of Iranian ports, and agree to a ceasefire. President Donald Trump told reporters at the White House today he didn't want to say whether a deal's been reached, but he insisted the strait was already open.
It's sort of open right now. You know, we have a thing called the blockade headed up by the U.S. Navy, and we control it. And now we control it, but they can always shoot something. They always have something or drop a mine. And if you have one mine sitting out there, you sort of mess things up because people don't want to take their billion-dollar boats and accidentally get hit by a mine. But I think we're doing very well. I just, you know, I'm involved in the negotiation. I think we're doing fine.
Vice President J.D. Vance struck a more cautious tone, telling Fox News that progress is slow because of Iran's fragmented political system.
It seems like we're making progress, and then it seems like we're not. Well, the reality, Laura, is that, number one, the Iranians are extraordinarily difficult people. Number two, they have a fractured system. So there are people within their system who want the war to be over. There are also people within their system who are crazy radicals who want the war to continue. Our job is to navigate through that and get the best outcome for the American people, but for the President of the United States as well. And I do think that where we will ultimately land, it's going to be messy and it's going to take some time to get there.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut said that Trump's comments about an impending deal are just another empty promise.
On 11 different instances, Trump says a deal is about to happen. Don't worry, the war is about to be over. There's no deal. None of it is real, these promises. I wish it were real. I want to be clear about that. I want the war to end.
The developments come as Iran presses Gulf states to push Trump to back off military strikes or face retaliation. Iranian officials say Tehran has warned Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey that any U.S. attacks on Iran's infrastructure would trigger strikes on Gulf energy and water facilities. Saudi Arabia's crown prince has urged Trump to pursue a ceasefire instead. On August 2nd, Trump said he'd agreed to hold off, quote, subject to being able to rapidly make a deal. Meanwhile, Israel launched airstrikes in southern Lebanon today after two Israeli soldiers were killed in an operation targeting suspected Hezbollah infrastructure. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reiterated Israel's commitment to preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Today we heard the commander of the Revolutionary Guards, Vahidi, explicitly declare Iran's intention to continue developing nuclear weapons. As the Prime Minister of Israel, I am also determined to continue preventing Iran from possessing nuclear weapons. Iran's Houthi allies in Yemen also claimed new attacks on Saudi forces this week, and a tanker reported hearing explosions near Oman while transiting the strait. Its crew and vessels were reported safe. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine has hit more oil facilities deep inside Russia. The attacks are part of Kyiv's effort to undermine Moscow's wartime economy. Ukrainian forces targeted refineries in Bashkortostan and Yaroslav region. They also hit Russian military patrol boats in the Black Sea. Meanwhile, Russian drone and glide bomb attacks across Ukraine killed at least three civilians and wounded 22 others. Zelensky said Ukraine is receiving only a third as many air defense missiles from partners as it did last year. He said the drop in anti-ballistic missile supplies has held throughout the first half of 2026, even though allies have stockpiles available. He's calling for decisions to speed up production and to allow missile manufacturing inside Ukraine. The warning came as the Financial Times reported President Donald Trump turned down Zelensky's request for hundreds of additional Patriot interceptor missiles during a White House meeting last week. Sources told the FT that Trump cited limited U.S. stockpiles, saying the missiles are needed to protect American facilities and allies in the Middle East. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has disputed reports that U.S. interceptor stocks are running low. Zelensky also said Ukrainian forces are focused on holding the eastern towns of Kostyantynivka and Sloviansk and said that Kyiv is continuing long-range strikes on Russia. Analysts say Russian President Vladimir Putin appears determined to exhaust Ukraine through sheer numbers, believing time is on his side in the four-year-old full-scale invasion. Meanwhile, Lithuanian Defense Minister Robertas Kaunas said Russia may be planning to use captured Ukrainian-made drones in a false flag operation against the Baltic region. Minister Kaunas said the goal would be to make NATO waver and cut support for Ukraine, but he insists that won't happen. It follows warnings from Poland and the Baltic states that Russia could stage an attack or sabotage to shift focus away from the Ukraine war. Lithuanian President Gitanas Nausėda said in July that intelligence pointed to possible Russian attacks on infrastructure. The Kremlin has dismissed those warnings as scare stories. Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia are all NATO members bordering Russia and strong backers of Kyiv. Russia has accused the Baltic states of letting Ukraine use their airspace for attacks, a claim they deny. Ukrainian drones have strayed into Baltic and Finnish airspace in recent months, which Kyiv blames on Russian signal jamming. Climate experts are sounding alarms about historic weather patterns this fall and winter. Scientists warn that this year's Super El Nino will bring heavy storms across the state and heighten the risk of landslides along the coastline. Thousands of California residents attended a virtual town hall to learn from scientists, public officials, and emergency preparedness experts on how California is preparing for stronger weather patterns before they occur. Andrea Jimenez reports.
El Nino is a naturally occurring warming of the tropical eastern Pacific Ocean that takes place every year. However, climate scientists and meteorologists are calling this year a Super El Nino, warning that it will bring destructive floods, storms, and lightning to fire-prone regions unlike anything we've seen before. Super El Ninos are rare, with only about 7 recorded in modern history. Over 5,700 people joined a virtual town hall led by State Senator Mike McGuire on August 4th to learn from scientists from across the state what Super El Nino is and how Californians can prepare for it. According to climate scientist Daniel Swain, weather patterns and models show that this year's El Nino is shaping up to be the strongest ever, warranting it the name of a Super El Nino.
I just want to emphasize that not all El Nino events are equal. And this one in particular right now is already a strong event as it has developed thus far and is expected to strengthen considerably from here, strengthening ultimately into a very strong or a so-called Super El Nino. That's what that term means. It just means it's a tier higher than strong, or it's very strong, and could even become potentially the strongest on record. In fact, that is what some of the best predictive models are currently indicating is a distinct possibility. So we may be seeing an event that we haven't really seen before in living memory in California.
Mark Merrifield of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography says an event of this magnitude is unprecedented. Experts don't know exactly how it will play out, but one thing is for certain. The highest sea levels on record are likely to occur this year.
For one thing, that we can for sure count on is that sea levels will increase. They are already starting to increase. The satellite image in the top left here shows sea levels over half a foot higher in the eastern Pacific. That anomaly is spreading northward, and we can expect by fall, winter of this year, that we should be seeing sea levels far above the average seasonal cycle going forward.
The Super El Nino is also set to bring high waves, high tides, and high rainfall, all of which increase the likelihood of coastal flooding and erosion. Experts say the most significant impacts are likely to occur between December and March and will bring an unusually wet winter. Nate Ortiz is the assistant director of the California Office of Emergency Services. Ortiz says there are some ways residents can prepare for the events Super El Nino could bring. He says people can do things like sign up for local emergency alerts and create a grab-and-go bag to have important documents ready to go at a moment's notice.
Gather key documents, keep things together, do the kind of prep work. So a grab-and-go bag is what we call it. It doesn't have to be fancy. Mine is in a Ziploc bag with, I think I put red paper on one side so I knew what it looked like. But, anything where you get your key documents together. And what are those? Those are passports, social security cards, birth certificates, anything like that. Health insurance cards, prescription list, whatever you may need.
Climate scientist Swain says El Nino is expected to intensify in the coming months. Given the high concern for coastal flooding, he advised residents in high-risk areas to consider obtaining flood insurance coverage. Standard home insurance does not cover flood damage. Bay Area coastal cities like Pacifica, Sausalito, San Francisco, and San Rafael, which are already prone to king tides, can expect severe flooding this year. For KPFA News, I'm Andrea Jimenez.
Climate change isn't just a concern for Californians, as the United Nations has issued stark warnings that the El Nino is pushing nearly 50 million more people into acute hunger. Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General.
2 months ago, I warned that El Nino was arriving on our doorstep. Now it is inside the house and turning up the heat. We have already endured a summer of extremes, record-shattering heat domes, apocalyptic wildfires raging in Spain, France, and far beyond. Thousands of lives lost in the scorching conditions and global sea surface temperatures with records in June and July. But according to the latest science, this is only a warm-up act. New forecasts released today by the World Meteorological Organization provide a stark picture of the period from August through October. El Niño is strengthening, adding fuel to a planet already on fire. The Pacific waters driving it have never been this warm, this early in an El Niño, and temperatures are still rising. Today's latest news indicates sea surface temperatures in key monitoring regions to average nearly 3 degrees Celsius above normal. At the same time, WMO's outlook shows that through October, nearly every land area on Earth is expected to be hotter than normal. Taken together, that risks shattering every seasonal record and driving even more severe effects worldwide. We are in uncharted territory.
A majority of scientists agree that climate change is a man-made issue. The UN Secretary General said that war is another man-made issue, further accelerating climate change. Along with humanitarian concerns over conflicts taking place in the Middle East, Guterres said fossil fuels used in conflict are contributing to heat waves and rising temperatures. He also added that some governments plan to produce more than twice as much fossil fuel in 2030 as the 1.5 degrees Celsius limits allow.
2 years ago, this month, I launched a call to action on extreme heat. And since then, we have helped more governments improve forecasts and early warnings. More cities have adopted heat action plans, and over 250 have joined the Beat the Heat initiative. These measures are saving lives, but the planet is heating faster than our response. We need far more action on four fronts. And first and fundamentally, the world must stop fueling the crisis. We hear much about record heat, drought, and wildfires, but not enough about the real change that is driving these events, the accelerating climate crisis powered by fossil fuels. It's time to stop treating each disaster as an isolated tragedy and recognize the systemic risk that is unfolding before our eyes. And make no mistake, the costs of fossil fuels are measured not only in climate disasters, but also in energy insecurity and geopolitical instability, as we see playing out today in the Middle East and beyond. Every new fossil fuel project approved today makes tomorrow heat waves more dangerous and our world less secure. Yet some governments still plan to produce more than twice as much fossil fuel in 2030 as the 1.5 degree limit allows. And fossil fuels still enjoy trillions of dollars a year in subsidies and underpricing. We are spending too much public money fueling the crisis and too little protecting the people from it. More coal, oil, and gas will lead to a more combustible future. Today's findings show that extreme heat is not a future threat. It is here. It is becoming more dangerous, and unless we act to protect people and tackle the root causes of the crisis, it will become deadlier still. The warm-up act is over. We cannot afford to wait for the main event. Thank you.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima marked the 81st anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb that ended World War II. Donna Warder reports.
A peace bell rang at 8:15 a.m. local time Thursday to mark 81 years ago when the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima and 3 days later Nagasaki. Hiroshima's mayor Kazumi Matsui criticized major powers for waging wars. He urged them to stop justifying the possession of nuclear weapons. Downplaying the inhumanity of nuclear weapons and accepting the use of force to pursue one's own prosperity risk cycles of violent retaliation that could ultimately result in another Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi says Japan has maintained its post-war three non-nuclear principles, but even it has fallen short of expressing commitment for sticking with the policy into the future. I'm Donna Warder.
Brazilian Senator Flavio Bolsonaro, son of imprisoned far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro, has named his running mate for October's presidential election. Jair Bolsonaro began serving his 27-year prison sentence in November of last year for leading a coup attempt after losing the 2022 election to Brazil's current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The younger Bolsonaro is the leading right-wing challenger, President Lula. He picked conservative Congressman Alfredo Gasper as his running mate. It's a surprise choice after weeks of uncertainty. He had considered adding a woman to broaden his appeal, but two potential picks failed to win their party's backing. Congressman Gasper represents Alagoas State and led a congressional probe into Brazil's Social Security Agency, an issue that touches Lula's son, who's been accused of receiving improper payments tied to the agency. He denies wrongdoing. An analyst says Gasper gives Bolsonaro a way to build support in Brazil's northeast, a Lula stronghold. Some major right-leaning parties have refused to formally back Bolsonaro nationally. Health authorities in Congo are monitoring passengers from a boat near Kinshasa after a traveler died with Ebola-like symptoms. Congo has been battling an Ebola outbreak since May with 4,000 confirmed cases, including more than 1,800 deaths. The boat had traveled for nearly 3 weeks along the Congo River with about 200 passengers, who are now in quarantine. News of the death caused panic in Kinshasa. Meanwhile, health workers took to the streets today to protest over unpaid wages, disrupting critical care. Karen Chemis has more.
The protest took place at the epicenter of the outbreak in Bunia, the capital of Ituri province, which accounts for nearly 90% of the Ebola cases in the country. Many workers abandoned several health facilities, even as aid workers warned that the disease is still spreading at an alarming rate. Confirmed cases in the outbreak, meanwhile, reached at least 3,973, with over 1,800 deaths, according to government data. It's the second largest Ebola outbreak on record, behind the 2014 to 2016 West Africa outbreak, in which more than 11,000 people died. I'm Karen Chemas.
President Donald Trump has dropped part of his $10 billion lawsuit against the BBC to avoid handing over his business financial records. Trump's legal team say he'll no longer claim the BBC's 2024 Panorama documentary caused financial harm to his businesses. He'll only pursue personal damages. That move came after his lawyers filed an emergency motion asking a judge to block an order requiring him to disclose financial records for at least 400 businesses held by his family trust, which is managed by his son, Donald Trump Jr. A U.S. magistrate judge had ruled last month that the BBC could access those records, since Trump's original lawsuit claimed the documentary damaged his brand and businesses. Since the records would eventually become public through the case, Trump's lawyers argued the order would cause, quote, irreparable harm. A Miami judge temporarily paused that order after Trump's team agreed to narrow the claims. BBC lawyers pushed back, questioning how Trump can claim $10 billion in harm while disclaiming damage to his businesses. The lawsuit stems from Trump's accusation that the BBC misleadingly edited his January 6th speech. The BBC has not commented. A Senate committee has voted to hold Dr. Anthony Fauci in contempt of Congress after he invoked the Fifth Amendment to avoid answering questions at a hearing on the COVID pandemic last week. Committee Chair Ron Paul, a longtime foe of Fauci, wants to skip a step in the process and send the referral directly to the Justice Department. Democrats blast the move as political theater, a show trial, and a dangerous precedent. Christopher Martinez reports.
Dr. Anthony Fauci served at the National Institutes of Health for 54 years, including nearly 40 as head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and finally as the White House medical advisor during the COVID pandemic. But if Republican Senator Rand Paul and his majority Republican Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee get their way, Fauci could be on the way to spend up to 1 year in prison.
On this vote, the yeas are 8, the nays are 5, and the motion is agreed to.
The committee vote, along party lines, comes 8 days after the committee called on Fauci to testify at a hearing on the COVID-19 pandemic, where, after an opening statement, Fauci refused to answer questions, invoking the Fifth Amendment 111 times. Committee Chair Paul explained the reason for the resolution, saying all he had to do was tell the truth. More than 100 times, though, he refused.
That is what we are voting on today. Not his opinions, not his policies, not anything he said from a podium 6 years ago. We are voting on whether a witness who has received the benefit of a sweeping federal pardon can be ordered by this committee to answer questions and then defy that order without consequence.
Other Republicans voiced their support for the contempt resolution, sometimes in a rather mocking tone. Senator Ron Johnson is a Republican from Wisconsin.
Last Wednesday's hearing was an excellent hearing. From a standpoint of legitimate questions being raised, legitimate questions the American people want answers to, legitimate questions that some of them only Anthony Fauci, Saint Fauci, Mr. Science could answer.
In addition to announcing he would vote yes on contempt, Johnson announced yet another interview with Fauci to come, this time to be transcribed and behind closed doors.
You say you have nothing to hide. Good, we'll do it behind closed doors. We'll transcribe it. That's only one of the interviews we'll be conducting. So again, no, this last week's hearing just began the accountability. There's a lot more accountability that's required.
Committee Chair Paul blasted Fauci specifically for giving an opening statement before taking the Fifth, with his attorney also trying to speak.
The Fifth Amendment doesn't allow you to testify on the other side of the question. Basically, you are allowed not to self-incriminate, but you're not allowed to say, oh, I'm not going to self-incriminate, but then I'm going to condemn the committee and the investigation. So he attempted to do that in his opening statement.
Democrats on the committee disagreed with Paul's interpretation. Richard Blumenthal is a Democrat from Connecticut.
And to respond to Senator Paul, there is well-established precedent that witnesses have their attorneys here make statements before the committee, even during the McCarthy hearings. There is also well-established precedent for a witness providing a statement at the outset and then declining to answer questions.
He cited a specific recent example to make his point.
President Trump invoked the Fifth Amendment 440 times in his deposition with the New York Attorney General. Nobody held him in contempt for doing so. This right is so fundamental that we ought to seriously consider before we take this immensely historic step.
After the party line vote in committee, the normal process is for the contempt referral to go to the full Senate for a vote. But Committee Chair Paul indicated last week that instead he would move it directly to the Justice Department in order to, in his words, not waste time. Meanwhile, the 85-year-old Dr. Fauci has now been subpoenaed by 3 Republican state attorneys general as part of a joint probe into his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
A government watchdog said Elon Musk's Doge overstated its federal savings claims. The Government Accountability Office reviewed $110 billion of the $215 billion in cuts Doge claimed on its website. Investigators found Doge took credit for lease cancellations that were already underway before the group existed and said it terminated contracts that actually weren't. Of $61 billion in claimed contract savings, the GAO said more than half, nearly $35 billion, couldn't be verified or wasn't actually terminated. The report was requested by Democratic Senators Gary Peters and Richard Blumenthal. Peters said Musk and the administration claimed savings they couldn't substantiate and refused to show their work. The GAO said it tried to get answers from Doge but got no response. Musk and the White House have not commented. Doge swept through federal agencies after President Trump's second term began dismantling USAID, USAID, and much of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. President Donald Trump said he is once again trying to limit birthright citizenship in the U.S. as he signed two executive actions on immigration today. Trump said he believed his latest actions will be constitutional. The move comes after the Trump administration appears to have missed a deadline to ask the Supreme Court to reconsider its rejection of the president's original birthright citizenship restrictions, which the high court ruled against earlier this year. Ed Donahue reports.
President Trump signed two executive actions on immigration. One deals with birthright citizenship. It would limit the number of people eligible to become U.S. citizens after being born in the country. The second would curb birth tourism, increasing visa restrictions on people who want to give birth in the U.S.
This will give us the right to do it in a much more forceful manner. But they've taken birthright citizenship and they've made a joke out of it.
The president tried at the start of his second term to end birthright citizenship. 2 months ago, the Supreme Court upheld a broad conception of it, rejecting the president's previous attempts to declare children born to people in the U.S. illegally or temporarily aren't American citizens.
Unfortunately, we had a bad decision, very unfair decision. Our country suffers because of it. And we're ending it a different way.
Opponents had sued, saying the earlier executive order went against the 14th Amendment. The president says he thinks his latest actions would be constitutional. Ed Donahue, Washington.
I'm Scott Bamba. You're listening to the Pacifica Evening News. We'll be back with more after this.
As a KPFK listener, you expect to hear smart conversations about important issues every time you turn on the radio. We bring you facts and analysis, not partisanship or hype, so you can form your own opinions on the news. You count on KPFK for informed, insightful reporting. Don't take coverage like this for granted. It's here for you, thanks to the generous financial support of our listeners. Support the programming you rely on right now by calling 818-985-5735 or contribute online at kpfk.org.
This is Chris Hedges, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, heard globally at kpfk.org.
A divided federal appeals court ruled this week that the Trump administration improperly terminated billions of dollars in clean energy funds, handing a win to nonprofits chosen to run the Biden-era program. The decision is on hold for several days, giving the EPA time to appeal to the Supreme Court. At issue is the Greenhouse Gas Reductions Fund, a $20 billion program known as a Green Bank, that financed loans for small energy projects. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin had accused the nonprofits of mismanagement and fraud, froze the money, and terminated their grants. The groups denied wrongdoing and sued. 6 of 10 judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit agreed the EPA likely violated the law when it terminated the grants over a policy disagreement. The remaining 4 judges sided with the EPA, arguing Trump's tax and spending law gave the agency authority to end the grants. The EPA has not commented on the ruling. The Senate Finance Committee held a hearing today on the solvency crisis facing Social Security. It's estimated the Social Security Trust Fund could become insolvent in 2032, which could lead to drastic cuts to retired and disabled American benefits unless action is taken to shore up its finances. Max Pringle reports.
Idaho Republican Mike Crapo chairs the Senate Finance Committee. He suggested forming a task force to study Social Security solvency that could produce a report that Congress could use to craft legislation. He referred to a 1983 commission that worked on the issue as a guide.
That process demonstrated the value of creating a forum where policymakers could work through difficult issues and build consensus on a bipartisan basis. More than 2 decades later, I participated in another bipartisan effort to develop recommendations to address our nation's long-term fiscal challenges. Along with Senator Dick Durbin, the Democratic co-author of one of the process bills that will be discussed today.
Oregon Senator Ron Wyden is the ranking Democrat on the panel. He said the time for special commissions is long past. He said Americans want action now from Congress to fix Social Security's solvency issues.
Trump and the MAGA crowd give huge tax breaks to billionaires and massive corporations. That's what they did last year. And that bill plundered Social Security by $168 billion. You don't have to take my word for it. The number comes from the Social Security Actuary Office itself.
Senator Wyden said the Democratic plan is to increase payroll taxes on wealthy Americans, who, on average, pay a much lower rate on payroll taxes than middle-income Americans.
That can be done by updating Social Security to reflect the economy of today and ask billionaires to pay their fair share through the payroll and income taxes. That's it. So I wish that the Finance Committee was here to make sure that we have a substantive debate. Instead, the concept being discussed today would act as a shortcut for Republicans to carry out their long-sought goal of slashing Social Security benefit for retirees and raising taxes on middle-class folks.
Rebecca Vallis is with the National Academy of Social Insurance. It's a nonpartisan think tank studying social insurance programs. She said Social Security has bipartisan support from most Americans, and she said they want wealthy Americans to contribute their fair share to keep the program solvent.
Americans across party lines, income, education, and generations support starting by reforming the payroll tax cap for higher earners and are also interested in looking to other sources of wealth and income that have increasingly escaped Social Security's financing structure as the economy has shifted.
Republicans have proposed fixes like cutting Social Security benefits and raising the retirement age, both of which are deeply unpopular with many Americans. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
The Federal Communications Commission has voted today to eliminate the rule capping local TV station ownership at 39% of U.S. households. The Republican-led commission voted 2-1 along party lines to scrap the cap in favor of reviewing ownership deals case by case. In a report given before the vote, Media Bureau Deputy Division Chief Chad Guo testified that the original rule had become obsolete.
Limiting the percentage of households that networks may reach through stations the networks could own and operate themselves once ensured the network's continued reliance on affiliated television stations for the nationwide distribution of network programming. However, now that networks can reach viewers directly via non-broadcast platforms, the national cap no longer plays a role in maintaining this balance. Instead, the national cap constrains the ability of broadcast television station owners to attract capital and generate revenue through achieving greater scale. Eliminating the national cap would remove these restrictions and provide leverage to owners of local broadcast television stations against national networks by enabling these station owners to expand their nationwide audience reach.
The government has limited broadcast ownership since 1941, aiming to preserve local control, a diversity of viewpoints, and competition in TV markets so that no single company could dominate what Americans watch. Congress raised the cap to its current 39% level in a 2004 law. FCC Chair Brendan Carr said the old law created unfair rules against the owners of local broadcasters.
National programmers are free to reach 100% of their relevant markets by distributing their programs direct to consumer or through deals they cut with virtual cable companies that have nationwide reach. Cable channels, they can reach 100% of the country. Social media sites, 100% too. Same with Netflix, podcasts, and all other forms of digital content. Even the old newspaper has no limits on marketing itself to 100% of households. But not so with the owners of local broadcast.
Carr added that the limitation imposed by the law negatively affected regulators as much as it did the companies under their purview.
The FCC has had a bright line rule that generally prevented the agency from even considering the merits of certain deals. Maybe a deal that exceeds a 39% cap is a good one. Maybe it's a bad one. Today's decision lets the parties make their case, allows all stakeholders to be heard, and ensures that the agency will decide consistent with our public interest review.
Carr said today's change will help local broadcasters survive. He cited a similar law that had limited outside investment in newspapers for similar reasons, arguing that rule had prevented companies from injecting financing into the industry when it was most needed, leading to the decline of local newspapers. He vowed not to make the same mistake with local broadcasters.
The FCC kept a rule on the books in the name of localism that contributed to the gutting of local newspapers. Maybe the FCC was slow to see the forest from the trees. Maybe just thought the politics were too fraught. It's always easier to say something must be done while doing nothing. The courts contributed to entertaining activist lawsuits to overturn FCC efforts at reform, but the outcome is the same either way. I don't want local broadcast TV to go the way of local newspapers.
Fellow Republican Commissioner Olivia Trustee said that the rule change would improve the health of local broadcast television.
Although I do not view this proceeding as a silver bullet to reverse audience or marketplace trends entirely, I do believe that eliminating the cap removes a regulatory constraint that can unnecessarily stand in the way of strengthening broadcasters' ability to compete and serve their communities. Greater scale can improve financial sustainability. It can provide additional resources to invest in local journalism, emergency coverage, investigative reporting, and community programming. It can improve broadcasters' bargaining position with national networks and enhance their ability to compete for valuable programming such as live sports. Most importantly, it can help strengthen broadcasters in the current marketplace. And stronger broadcasters are better positioned to continue fulfilling the public interest obligations that Congress has assigned to them.
The lone Democrat on the panel, Ana Gomez, disagreed. She conceded that the economic model for local broadcast stations has become increasingly precarious as changes in technology, and especially social media, create new competition for market share. But she said removing the cap would not solve the problem.
Broadcasters are being squeezed from both sides. Digital giants compete for their most valuable programming and advertising, while consolidation pressures at the national level threaten the local reporting and public safety functions on which communities rely. But eliminating the cap does not free local broadcasters from that strain. It just changes who is doing the squeezing. A handful of station group giants does not represent the wishes of local broadcasters. They are large national companies that own local stations and increasingly dictate what airs on them without much local input. Trading a squeeze from big tech for a squeeze from big media does nothing to protect the communities this cap was designed to serve.
Gomez noted that the move could be illegal, saying only Congress can lift the cap. She said that that was not a partisan opinion.
It's worth noting that Republicans with deep firsthand knowledge of this issue also agree the commission cannot do what it is attempting to do today. Former FCC Commissioner Michael Riley has been unequivocal that the FCC lacks authority to change the cap. Former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who negotiated the 39% compromise, has stressed that Congress intentionally wrote the cap into law to prevent FCC revision. And Senate Commerce Chair Ted Cruz has said he is skeptical a change can be made absent an act of Congress.
More than just illegal, Gomez said removing the cap is bad policy.
It invites further consolidation at a time when consolidation has consistently resulted in newsroom mergers, content duplication, fewer independent voices, and higher retransmission consent fees passed directly to consumers. It strengthens negotiating leverage for large national owners while doing nothing to ensure that the gains from consolidation translate into increasing community-focused reporting or improving emergency communications.
Gomez also warned the move could hand more control of the airwaves to a small number of large companies favored by the Trump administration, like Nexstar and Sinclair, which have the president's backing to expand. Notably, the vote follows the agency's approval in March of Nexstar's $3.5 billion purchase of Tegna, which would let Nexstar reach 80% of U.S. households, a deal currently on hold amid a court challenge. Critics, including some conservatives like Newsmax chief Chris Ruddy, say the change could fuel harmful consolidation. In 2018, sports and at the time culture blog Deadspin compiled a video of dozens of Sinclair-owned news stations all reading the same ostensibly original script.
The sharing of biased and false news
has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media publish things that are simply untrue without checking facts first. Unfortunately, some members of the media use their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think, and this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Public interest groups have vowed to sue. Meanwhile, the FCC took up additional proposals today at its monthly meeting. Among the items explored were a new phone-to-satellite connection and proposed changes to how rural hospitals and clinics get connected to broadband. KPFA's Annetta Felix has the details.
The Federal Communications Commission met Thursday to vote on proposals that could affect your phone, healthcare in rural America, among others. First on the agenda was satellites. Cell towers don't reach everywhere, so when you drive through the mountains or a rural stretch of highway, your phone can lose signal, except if you have a satellite phone. But the FCC just voted to change that. The plan is for your regular phone to connect straight to a satellite without a satellite phone. That's called direct-to-device technology, or D2D. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr says the goal is to keep your phone connected, even in places with no cell towers like mountains, rural roads, and disaster zones.
D2D services will allow consumers to connect directly from their smartphone or other device to a low Earth orbit satellite. No need for a standalone satellite dish, and that will mean instant and ubiquitous connectivity.
But not everyone was fully on board. Commissioner Gomez voted yes, but warned that squeezing a new use into already crowded airwaves needs a careful look.
I'm glad to see that the FCC is continuously thinking about ways to support technological innovation and to improve spectrum utilization. At the same time, I am concerned about the effect this new use could have on existing permitted unlicensed uses in already congested bands. That is why, as we explore permitting innovative uses of spectrum like the one described in this NPRM, it is critical that we ask thorough questions and ground our proposals in technological studies that help us to strike the right balance between allowing new uses without undoing previous technological advances.
The measure passed, but the public will get weeks to weigh in before the FCC writes an actual rule. Finally, on rural healthcare, the FCC runs a program that helps pay for high-speed internet at hospitals and clinics in rural areas. Commissioner Trustee says she visited hospitals which provide life-saving care for remote patients via doctor visits or telehealth. Commissioners voted to speed up funding for the program across America, from Alaska to New Mexico.
In Alaska, I saw firsthand the importance of broadband-enabled medical care in some of our nation's most remote communities, including Eek and the Kenai Peninsula. In Kansas, I met with broadband providers working to ensure disabled veterans can access the healthcare services they need.
That rule passed unanimously. The satellite plan and the rural hospital plan would both be open for public comment before they become final. Reporting for KPFA Radio, I'm Annetta Felix.
NASA astronauts have completed the 96th U.S. spacewalk at the International Space Station as an Elon Musk-launched rocket crashed into the moon. Joan Walsh reports.
NASA astronauts Anil Menton and Jessica Meir completed a 6-hour and 27-minute spacewalk to upgrade the International Space Station's electrical system. The astronauts prepared one of the station's power channels for future installation of a new rollout solar arrays known as IROSAs. The arrays will provide additional power for critical station operations and eventual support its safe, controlled deorbit. It was the 281st spacewalk conducted in support of the station's assembly, maintenance, and upgrades. The mission marked Menton's first spacewalk and Meyer's sixth, but it marked the United States' 96th spacewalk.
As Anil Menon and Jessica Meir have safely returned back inside the International Space Station, their helmets and gloves now coming off, and they will get situated back again as another spacewalk right around the corner again on Thursday, August 13th.
The spacewalk comes a day after a pair of lunar landers launched from SpaceX rocket after drifting off course for the past year slammed into the moon. Lunar litter and crashing space debris are growing concerns that many fear will worsen amid a new space race among billionaires. NASA insists the crash poses no danger to Earth, while astronomers have been waiting to catch a glimpse of the crash site to study the debris that may have been caused by the collision. Juliana Scheinman, director of NASA science at SpaceX, says the company is working to avoid future wrecks, stressing that this projected crash was not deliberate. She claimed that a combination of solar activity and gravity accidentally put it on a collision course with the moon.
What has happened is essentially a mixture of solar activity and gravity forces have put it on a path towards the moon. One of the things that we're working in partnership with NASA and the other appropriate agencies is what is the best future disposal path for high energy missions that are in a, you know, the sun, Earth, moon system.
The Associated Press reports that a Korean satellite has captured the first pictures of the moon's fresh crash scene. The Denuri spacecraft flew over the impact site soon after a SpaceX rocket inadvertently plowed into the moon Wednesday. Denuri made multiple passes from the lunar orbit. This terrain is noticeably darker when the rocket hit and carved out a crater. The Korea Aerospace Research Institute released the photos Thursday. NASA expects its lunar orbiter to fly over the crash site next week. Despite the air, stock in Elon Musk's space company rose Thursday, even after many SpaceX insiders were freed up to sell for the first time. In June, Musk sold SpaceX shares to the public for the first time in the biggest initial public offering ever. Shares jumped as high as $225 a share, briefly making Musk a trillionaire. Meanwhile, a rare total solar eclipse is set to sweep over parts of Europe next week. The event is expected to boost tourism in Spain, where the path of total darkness will pass on August 12th. Parts of Greenland, Iceland, and Portugal will also experience the eclipse. For KPFA News, I'm Joan Walsh.
California's uninsured rate could nearly double to almost 15% by 2030, according to new reporting by the independent newsroom CalMatters. This only 2 years after the state had managed to reach an insured rate of 95%. Budget shortfalls and new federal restrictions are forcing the state to roll back a health care coverage system it spent over a decade building. Researchers at UC Berkeley and UCLA project an estimated 2.2 million Californians could lose insurance over the next 4 years, with the losses hitting hardest among undocumented immigrants and low-income residents. Southern California is expected to see the steepest declines, and Black, Asian, and Latino Californians will lose coverage at higher rates than other groups. The losses stem largely from President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill tax and spending law, which rewrote Medicaid rules and cut federal funding to California. State officials estimate California's Medicaid program, Medi-Cal, could lose more than $30 billion a year once the changes fully take effect next year. The law's biggest change requires many adults to prove they're working or volunteering at least 80 hours a month to keep coverage, along with shorter eligibility periods. Past experience with Medicaid work requirements offers a preview of what could unfold nationally. A 2021 federal review by the Department of Health and Human Services found that when Arkansas implemented a similar work requirement in 2018, roughly 18,000 beneficiaries, about a quarter of those subject to the rule, were disenrolled for noncompliance within 9 months, with no corresponding increase in employment. Overall, the requirement cut Medicaid coverage in the targeted population by 12 percentage points. The review found more than 95% of those subject to the rule were already working enough hours or should have qualified for an exemption, but lost coverage anyway, largely due to confusion and lack of awareness about the reporting requirements. Similar patterns emerged elsewhere. New Hampshire's work requirement would have removed 67% of those subject to it had courts not blocked it, And in Michigan, nearly a third of beneficiaries, roughly 80,000 people, faced losing coverage of its version before it too was struck down. Last week, a federal judge rejected a bid by California and two dozen other states to pause the Big Beautiful Bill work requirements nationwide, ruling he wasn't convinced the rules would cause irreparable harm. The judge did say the states could still challenge requirements on the merits. The Big Beautiful Bill also let enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies expire, which has already cut covered California enrollment by 140,000 people. Meanwhile, the state has already made its own cuts to slow Medi-Cal's growth. In January, California froze enrollment for undocumented adults, and starting next summer, immigrants without legal status will lose dental benefits and face new monthly premiums. Changes expected to push about 800,000 people off coverage. State lawmakers also dropped coverage of weight loss drugs for people who are simply overweight, scaled back case management and medical meal delivery services, and reinstated a wealth test that caps how much savings enrollees can have. State officials note lawmakers approved the budget behind the cuts, and despite the changes, Governor Newsom said he remains committed to supporting universal coverage. As the hits to Medi-Cal continue to come fast and furious, California is funding a network of thousands of community health workers, also known as Promotoras, to help low-income families understand health insurance options. Suzanne Potter reports.
A few years ago, the state added these services as a benefit in Medi-Cal, which is the Golden State's Medicaid program. Mar Belez, policy director with the Latino Coalition for a Healthy California, says they're trusted bilingual messengers who can lay out the changes clearly.
Community health workers, promotoras de salud, are the lifeline to our community to be able to adhere to these new burdensome requirements. We need to ensure that they continue to be funded, protected from any state cuts.
Republicans in Congress passed huge cuts to Medicaid last summer and put the savings toward immigration enforcement and tax cuts. As a result, starting in January, people on Medi-Cal will have to follow new work requirements and recertify their eligibility every 6 months. California froze new enrollment for undocumented families starting last January. Starting next July, many undocumented families will lose dental coverage and have a new copay for medical visits. Nora Vigil is a patient service advocate with Lifelong Medical Care in Berkeley, trained by the advocacy group Visión y Compromiso. She says the immigration crackdown has many families running scared.
One of the problems that we have now in the clinic is that they don't want to come to be assisted because they are afraid that we are connected with immigration. People, they are afraid to be deported.
In addition, federal cuts to the SNAP program mean many low-income families are losing access to CalFresh food assistance. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A landmark California law requiring disclosure of AI-generated content took effect over the weekend, timed to coincide with new European Union regulations. The California AI Transparency Act requires companies using generative AI to embed digital markers, like a digital signature, disclosing that fact in a piece of content's metadata. Democratic State Senator Josh Becker, the law's co-author, called it a, quote, nutrition list of what went into the content. Becker said the law aims to combat deepfakes, scams, and election misinformation. A new bill, Senate Bill 1000, would expand the requirement to all generative AI products, regardless of user base. Companies hosting social media content have until January 1st to comply, including for user-generated content. Violators face up to fines of up to $5,000 per violation. Google rolled back an AI image generation feature it introduced in Google Earth this week, just a day after launch, following criticism over its potential for misinformation. The tool, powered by Google's Nano Banana 2 model, let users generate photorealistic images on top of real satellite and aerial imagery using text prompts, raising concerns it could be used to fabricate scenes at real-world landmarks and monuments. Google said it saw people sharing screenshots of AI-generated images that appeared to violate company policies, though it hasn't specified what those violations were. The company defended the tool, saying the generated images didn't appear in the main Google Earth experience and were watermarked as AI-created. Investigator and AI tool researcher Hank Van S. posted his own experiments with the tool at social media, which included placing a refugee camp on the U.S.-Mexico border and a nuclear plant in Iran. Commenters on his post noted Google's AI watermark could be easily sidestepped by techniques as simple as taking a picture of the original picture. Bay Area weather this evening, mostly clear, lows around 60, partly cloudy tomorrow morning before becoming sunny.
Support for KPFK is brought to you in part by the LA Jazz Festival, presenting multiple neighborhood park concerts across all 15 LA districts from August 7th through August 23rd. Featured artists include Layla Hathaway, Maurice Brown, and Billy Childs, leading up to a